Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Mishpatim. This week, Rabbi David Levenkruis discusses Mishpatim. Rabbi David Levenkruis is a member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Director of Special Projects. And now, Rabbi David Levenkruis.
Shabbat Shalom. Even in today's news and journalistic world, which is very, very different from what things were like maybe 20 years ago, people still want that exclusive interview, the ability to interview or to speak to that famous person, this child who went through a horrific occurrence, that woman who's doing something new. An exclusive interview is what every journalist is after. And in fact, in this week's parasha, Mishpatim, we have, if not an exclusive interview, an exclusive meeting between God and Moshe, Aaron, Nadav, Avihu, and 70 of Israel's elders. And the question that I'm going to throw out today is, can God be interviewed? And if we can interview God, what is the vision, what is the idea of God that we would get from the interview? Shmot 33:20, which is not in our parsha, it's earlier on when Moshe asks to see God, seems to be very, very clear. Vayomer, and God said, Lo tuchal lirot et panai, you cannot see my face, ki lo yireni hadam v'chai, because a person cannot see me and live. And according to this, there is no chance to see God. If you were to see God, you would the power, the overwhelming nature of this experience would totally destroy you. And we could just stop the podcast now. But if we look at the Yalkut, which is a midrashic work of Yitro, 286, as well as the Mechilta, B'Shalach Shirata 4, this is all as retold in the Book of Legends, we read, an incredible midrash, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God, which we just read in last week's parasha. Lefi shenira lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God appears to them in different ways. Alayam kegibor oseh milchama, on the sea as a war hero. That was at the Red Sea. V'nirahem b'Sinai kesofer melamed Torah, and on Sinai he was a teacher teaching Torah. V'nirahem b'yemei Shlomo kebachur, and in the days of Solomon he was like a young man. V'nirelahem b'mei Daniel k'zaken male rachamim, in the days of Daniel, he was an old man full of compassion. And we have a beautiful insight not only into God over here, but into the rabbis and how they saw God and how they saw themselves at the Red Sea as a mighty person waging war, but at Sinai, k'sofer melamed Torah, as a sage, as a scribe teaching Torah. And who were scribes teaching Torah? Who, if not they themselves? They themselves saw themselves at Mount Sinai. In Solomon, he was a bachur, a young, virile man. And in the book of Daniel, again, as an old man full of compassion. Again here, a vision closer to the rabbis themselves, teaching Torah, full of compassion, but also very aware of God as being the hero of war, or the young man. Some people who know Anim Zmirot, the hymn that is sung at the end of Shabbat morning in Shul, will realize some of these images. And immediately, I'm sure you and I are asking the same question. First of all, how can God be seen this way? And secondly, how in all these different guises? What about one God? Didn't I learn that at some point? Amar lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God said to them, Lo bishvil sha'atem ro'im oti d'muyot harbei, just because you see me in lots of different images, don't think tidmu sheyesh harbei elohot. It doesn't mean that there are lots of different gods. Ela ani hu shebayam. I'm the one who is in the sea, and I'm the one who was at Sinai. Ani hu b'shebu Sinai. Ani hu shebekol makom. I am everywhere that you see God. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am the Lord your God. In this we have a powerful idea of a God who's not hidden, a God who might be ethereal, but who appears to us in ways that we can see. And these are, of course, metaphors. But nevertheless, it's a very, very different idea from the idea that we see in Shmot. Shmot is much more like the Rambam, Maimonides, who saw God as impossible to be understood. The one from the Book of Legends, the Yalkut, the Mechilta, is much, much more a Hasidic, not Hasidic, a Kabbalistic way of seeing God. But very, very interestingly, sometimes liberal Christians bring up this piece and say that this is actually what the Trinity is about. The Trinity is not as Jews often imagine, that God is three gods, but three guises of the same God. And we see that in this piece over here. True, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I'm pretty sure that the idea is partly affected by each other. So we have two radical ideas over here. One, that God cannot be seen. The next, that God can be very, very much seen. And we have our incident that happens in our parasha as maybe a bridging device. We read in Shmot 24, verses 9 to 10, V'ya'al Moshe v'Aaron v'Nadav v'Amihu v'Shiv'im v'Ziknei Yisrael. We're setting the scene. There is Moshe, Aaron, his brother Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. V'yir'u et Elohei Yisrael, and they saw the God of Israel. V'tachat raglav k'maseh livnat hasapir, and under his feet was something like a sapphire brick, a brick of the sapphire. Uka etzem hashamayim, like the essence of heaven, letohar, for purity. So we now have, perhaps not as graphic as the Yalkut, we now have another vision of God, slightly more ethereal, but also very, very much a real vision of God. Let us now go word for word through this description of God, and I think it will help us understand something about God's essence, how God appears to us, and will answer the question about whether, in fact, it is possible to interview God and for human beings to get an understanding or a glimpse of an understanding of what God is. God is called the God of Israel, Elohei Yisrael. The Etz Chaim, the conservative commentary on the Torah, contemporary conservative commentary, writes, the name befits the context of the special relationship now being forged between God and Israel. So this idea that we've already gotten of God as somehow part of the people, one of the people, able to be seen with the people, is now emphasized when we speak about a special relationship which is being forged. And why the feet? What is so important about the feet? If you look at Yeshayahu, it says, Ko amar Adonai, hashamayim kisi, va'aretz hadom ragli. God says, heaven is my throne, and the earth is at my feet. There's something about feet that makes it connected to the world. If we think of God as a person who is in heaven, we're using a very graphic understanding of it, then God is up there and God's feet are down there. And similarly, we read in Yeshayahu 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw God on a high and lofty throne, and the skirts of his robe filled the temple, and the shulav meleim et ha'echal. There's something about God and the bottom of God, by which I don't mean his bum, but his feet that touch the earth, that touch the temple. And the Zohar says, just as feet come in contact with the ground, so allegorically God's feet are the attribute that comes in contact with the level below. They are therefore seen as a mean of prophecy. And this, I think, is a wonderful idea. Prophecy happens where God's lowest part of God, the lowest part of God's body, and of course this is metaphor, kivyachol, as the Gemara says, where the lowest part of God's body touches the earth. The Moreh Nevuchim, the Rambam, says feet denote the ultimate essence of creation. He's being very Maimonidean here, talking about it as a metaphor. But the fact is, even for people, shoes and feet have got a special have got a special significance. It's fascinating if you look at the brachot that are said, the blessings that are said as part of Shacharit, the morning service. We see that all of the blessings, the early morning blessings, are said in general. Pokeach Ivrim opens the eyes of the blind, Malbish Aramim closes the naked, except for one blessing, which is Asali called Tzorki, who has fulfilled all my needs. And this is the blessing that was originally said when people put their shoes on in the morning. And it's in the singular, because in ancient times people would share robes, they would share trousers, they would share belts, but they would not share shoes. There was something personal about shoes that they could not be shared. Even today they say it's not good to wear other people's shoes. And it's interesting, the blessing has fulfilled me all my needs. Because if I had a pair of shoes, I could go out and work. It wasn't really God fulfilling all the needs. It's thank you for the pair of shoes. Because if I have a pair of shoes, I am able to go out and work. And just as for people, shoes and feet represent the ability to go out into the world and do stuff, so for God, feet is a symbol of being able to go out into the world and to do stuff. Let's now move on and discuss the sapphire. In Yechezkel, the book of Ezekiel, it says, Uma lerakia asher al rosham kamare even sapir demut kiseh. We see that they're talking about God and the angels, and above the angels is the throne, something like a throne, which was sapphire. So we're getting the idea that God's throne is sapphire, and if the sapphire is blue, as we will see later, this would explain why the sky is blue, if God's throne is above the sky. But this is no regular stone. Sapir, says Bachya, is related to wisdom, and the Tzioni explains that the word sapir is connected to sefer, book. So we have this great, awesome scene, this ethereal scene, and once again, just as at Mount Sinai, in the Mechilta and the Yalkut, sapir, God is seen as God of wisdom, God who reads, God who teaches from a book. And the Ravid say that some say the sapphire is like a third eye through which mystical vision is attained. So we're beginning to get an idea a little bit of what this netherworld looks like, that God is somehow part of this world, that God does things in this world. And this is reinforced when we learn to understand what the brick means. Rashi says, they're talking about this brick, and it said God saw this during the slavery as a symbol of Israel's woes. Liskor tzaratan shel Yisrael shayu meshubadim b'maseh levanim, for they were subject to brickwork. What it's saying over here is this brick that is in God's throne is a memory of the bricks that Am Yisrael would make in Mitzrayim, that the Jewish people would do in Egypt. There's something so beautiful to me about this idea of God's throne having a brick, having something to remember slavery. It reminds me a little bit of the contemporary Jewish custom of leaving a little bit of the house not fixed in order to remember the destruction of the temple. The Sifri says that this was the brick out of which the tablets of the law would be carved. And the Yerushalmi says that we're talking about brickworking tools. And I think these three commentaries, in some beautiful way, summarize maybe all of Judaism. We were slaves. We left Egypt and got the tablets of the law. And we, in the law, were commandments. And we, as with brickworking tools, observe the commandments. That could be all of Yiddishkeit is there in one brick. God remembers our slavery, our acceptance of the Torah, and the fact that we can do it. So far, we've had a hint about the blue, but we don't really have an idea of what the color is like. In Sota, we have this beautiful piece. D'Tanya was learned in a Baraita. Haya Rabbi Meir Omer. Rabbi Meir used to say, Ma nishtana techelet mekol minei tzivotam? Why is techelet, why is blue different from all other colors? Because blue is similar to the color of the sea. The color of the sea is similar to the color of the heavens. The color of the heavens is similar to the color of the sapphire. And the color of the sapphire is similar to the color of the throne of glory. And they quote the pasuk that we have seen, and we pasuk quote the pasuk from Yechezkel. They're saying there's something special about Techelet, because Techelet is the color of God's throne. Why, ladies and gentlemen, could they not just have said it? We have been taught that Rabbi Meir used to say, why is blue different from all the other colors? Because blue is similar to the color of the throne of glory. There are many, many ideas that are shared about why we have to go through this rigmarole. This is like this, that is like that, that is like this, this is like that. But the one that I like the most is, in order to reach God, we cannot go directly through God. We have to go through the world. We have to take care of the world. We have to be part of the world. We have to be in the world, and one thing in the world will take us to something else in the world, and something else in the world will take us to something else in the world that is even higher, and we will go higher and higher until we see God. But we get to God through this world, and only if we care about the world and are part of this world can we discover God. We've been emphasizing, or I've been emphasizing very, very strongly, the idea of God being part of this world, God being available in this world, God choosing to express God's self in ways that human beings can see. But I think that there's another theme also going through. The Rashbam says something like the whiteness of a sapphire. It's speaking about not about blue, but it about it being white. And the Ralbag says, their vision may have been of pure empty space. You know what might have happened over there, ladies and gentlemen? It may not have been that they saw God in technicolor. What they saw over there was God as empty space. They were different. They were able to see God in the empty space. It's not that there were vast shapes, some separate and fantastic opportunity. They were at the spiritual level that they were able to see God. And I think this idea balances the very graphic ideas I've just said. And I think what this whole selection of quotes does so beautifully is it manages to emphasize both. It manages to emphasize that God can be part of this world. God can be understood, at least some parts of God can be understood by us. God can be human, but God can be seen in human terms, I should say, but also that what we see will be an indicator, will point us to something greater, something otherworldly, something ethereal. Rabbi Sam Raphael Hirsch, who was quite a critic of the Rambam, pointed out that the Rambam was so scared that if we saw God in graphic terms, we would get to idolatry. And he said the Rambam was wrong. If anything, the Rambam's abstract God, the God who's an X in the equation, his Aristotelian God, if anything, said Hirsch, that is what's going to lead people to disbelieve in God. In fact, seeing God in more graphic terms helps us to be able to see God, to understand God, to relate to God. And I think these texts, in a very, very beautiful way, balance both Hirsch and the Rambam. We see God in the everydayness that Hirsch speaks about, but we know very, very well that there's the abstract and the otherworldliness of the Rambam. So if I were to answer the question I posed at the beginning, can one interview God? My answer is unequivocally, yes, we can interview God. We would discover a God who is discoverable and not discoverable at the same time. We would find a God who is very much can be part of this world, but at the same time is very much not. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Levenkreuz. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.